Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
In an election season that has already seen surprising twists and turns, WNYC will be there to cover whatever comes next and help you make informed decisions. With WNYC reporters across the city, Brian Lehrer in the studio, and you adding your voice to the conversation. Stay with WNYC on air and online this election season and follow our mayor tracker at wnyc.org/election.
WNYC support comes from the Q Forest School in Queens, inspiring students to achieve since 1918. Open house for all grades, nursery through 12th, on Thursday, October 17th at 5 p.m. Information online at kewforest.org. 12th Night and Richard III, in repertory on Broadway for 16 weeks. Mark Rylance appears in both plays and Stephen Fry appears in 12th Night. Performances feature original Elizabethan staging, including onstage seating. Previews begin October 15th. ShakespeareBroadway.com. WNYC is a media partner of the Rethinking Mortality, Exploring the Boundaries Between Life and Death lecture series at the New York Academy of Sciences, starting October 9th. Details at nyas.org/mortality.
Brian Lehrer and WNYC. So what happens when you put an outspoken British documentary filmmaker with a trip-hop band from the 90s in a giant decommissioned armory? A new show called Massive Attack, The Adam Curtis, is a narrative documentary with a live score, and it's a commentary on state-managed fear, over-policing, the 24-hour news cycle, the death of heroism, and our obsession with ourselves. Filmmaker Adam Curtis, who you may know from his BBC film series The Power of Nightmares or for many other films, is here to discuss this collaboration that he did with Robert Del Naja of Massive Attack in the show playing through October 4th at the Park Avenue Armory. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you.
So the experience of attending this event, first of all, you walk into this enormous space that is the Park Avenue Armory, and you're surrounded by 11 gigantic screens on three sides of you. Everyone is standing. The film is projected on each of the 11 screens. The band is located behind a few of the screens. Explain what happens for the hour and a half of the performance.
Well, I don't want to give too much away, but you're right. It's 97 minutes long, to be precise, and we ask the audience, 2,000 people, to stand there every night. The thinking of that is that I'm a bit wary of how whimsical and sweet a lot of the modern art has become. I mean, as you say, I'm not actually an artist. I'm a journalist, a political filmmaker. I'm interested in trying to actually make people think and feel and look at the world in different ways. Really what I try and do is say, look, have you thought about looking at the world this way? Now go away and think about it. You may disagree with me, but this is what I want to provoke, that sort of thought. And if you're offered the chance of working with a famous rock band, what I began to realize is that you have a chance to actually create a way that you're not only telling people what you think and provoking them through words and images, you've got an ability to let them experience that. So that's what Robert and I tried to build, was a world that you went into for 90 minutes, which sometimes becomes quite intense and oppressive, to try and experience the argument.
So in the film, early on, there's footage of the Chernobyl disaster and the workers who you argue heroically gave their lives to clean up. There's footage of brutality under Ceausescu in Romania, footage of Jane Fonda's workout video, Serbian punk singer Igor Letov. Here's a bit of the music from your trailer, which Massive Attack fans will recognize.
Walking through the suburbs, they're not exactly lovers, you're a couple, especially when your body's double duplicating and you wait for the next Kuwait, coma, coma.
And on the screens, you see in giant letters, in the past, politicians wanted to change things, including you. The new system listens to you, observes you, understands you, and gives you what it knows you want. If you like that, then you will love this, unquote. And your argument seems to be that we live in an echo chamber managed by politicians and captains of industry. So can you articulate what kind of world you see us living in right now, and why you frame it in terms of a kind of responsiveness that language I just read seems to reflect?
Well, what I wanted to try and bring into focus in this is just what I think is a great shift, a very recent shift, into a new kind of society, which I don't think we quite realise the full dimensions of. I mean, we know that the age of optimism and imagining great and different futures has gone, but no one's really asked what kind of society it is that we live in. I mean, many people say, oh, it's just the free market. I think it's far wider than that.
What's gone?
What has gone is that sense of progressive optimism that really characterised most of the 20th century, not just in Russia and not just in my country, but in your country too. I can't tell you, if you go back as recently to the 50s and 60s and look at the technocratic optimism that scientists, politicians and technocrats offered your society, it's amazing. Now,
Obama
you have,
was elected on hope and change. We have a similar movement to some degree in New York right now with the current Democratic mayoral candidate, Bill de Blasio, seems to be running on hope and change.
It's difficult for me to come in and say absolute things about your society, but from an outsider's point of view, what it would seem to me is that much of the our politicians use the same words, but actually what it is a great deal of rhetoric. Because where is the change? I mean, the arguments within our societies between what are called the left and the right are simply about how you manage one particular system. I mean, the fault is really, to a great degree, on the left and the liberal left. I mean, one of the things I was completely shocked about, both in my country and in yours, is the total failure of the Occupy movement to actually capitalise upon that moment of really goodwill amongst a great deal of people who would not normally be sympathetic to radical movements. They blew it, and they blew it because they just got obsessed by how you manage the system of their own Occupy movement.
But maybe I didn't expect this to become a dialogue about the Occupy movement, but maybe there are different ways to have influence. The Tea Party is doing it by getting elected to Congress, and we see what they're causing this very day. Maybe the Occupy movement did it by inspiring on another level, and now we have the next likely mayor of New York running on inequality, which is the Occupy movement's mantra.
Well, I mean, let me put it like this. You have in this country, and you have to an extent in my country, but more so in this country, an argument between left and right. But it's about how you manage the system you have and also how you would adjust the levels of inequality within it. What has disappeared is an idea that you can actually transform whole societies and change, to be blunt, the structure of power in a society. That's what I'm trying to bring into focus in this, is that what you have shifted away from is an idea which can be dangerous, but also can be thrilling, that you could actually transform societies in fundamental ways, a progressive idea. What you've got instead is what I try and bring into focus in the show is a managerial system whereby our desires, what you want, what you feel, is often fed back to you. I mean, I've made films in the past about the rise of focus groups within mm-hmm. politics, which actually, to be honest, came through the left most more than the right, through Bill Clinton and through Tony Blair in my own country, in which you give up saying to people, look, I have a vision of the future, and if you give me your vote, I will take you there, which is a sort of old, to use a bad word, patrician view of the world. What replaced that was a feedback system where I say to you, come into my focus group, drink a little bit of wine, tell me what your desires, your worries, your fears about the future are, and I will deal with them. And the people I get most concerned with are what are called the swing voters, the ones who actually might change their mind. So I go and find in my country, it's about 18,000 people who might change their mind. And I ask them, over the glass of wine, what they would like. And I say, I'll give it to you. Those swing voters hopefully swing their vote, and the country has a different political system. That is not a radical system of political change. That is a managerial system which often uses the rhetoric of hope, change, future, but actually simply keeps a system tweaked. Whether you want to tweak it towards the state or whether you want to tweak it towards the free market, the system remains the same. That's what I'm trying to bring into focus in the show.
And so the villains in the movie include Donald Trump, Ceausescu, Prozac, and Ted Turner. And you say of Ted Turner, instead of trying to change the world in his creation of CNN, he just wanted to show us the world all day long. Is that related to what you were just talking about?
I don't think they're villains. I mean, I think, to be honest, if there are any villains in this piece, it's us. I mean, it's our... We are entranced by the idea that people focus on us. You know that phrase that they have on Amazon, which is, if you like that, then you'll love this. Mm. I think that's the mantra of our time. That's the ideology of our time. And what it is it's saying to you, what you liked yesterday, we can give you more of. So you get trapped in this feedback system where you're constantly haunted by your own desires. They come back and they seduce you. And that is a modern system of management, which becomes very, very static. The people you mentioned, people like Ted Turner, I think were agents of this transformation. I mean, they were brilliant entrepreneurs. They're not villains. I mean, Turner was a fascinating man. He shifted us away from the sort of thing the BBC does, which has elitist commentators who bestride the globe and tell you what's what, wagging their fingers at the camera, to an idea that you just open up the camera on the world. I mean, of course, it's edited, and just watch it 24 hours a day. That was a great shift in sensibility. I mean, I think it's extraordinary. And Jane Fonda, for example, is also fascinating. She moved away from that radicalism of the 1960s, which was about changing the world through socialism, towards this idea that you actually manage yourself. You don't try and change the world. You change yourself. You change your body. Her workout videos, which, interesting enough, started the whole VHS revolution, were all about managing yourself. And originally it was about changing yourself and empowering yourself. But actually, in the end, it's about managing yourself, keeping yourself steady, static.
Here's a quote from the New York Times review of the piece. At its best, the film forces you to think broadly and across category. But during the film's pedantic crescendos, that feeling of space drastically shrinks through shrill and nearly paranoid messaging, unquote. So after an hour and a half of what the Times sees as a borderline paranoid messaging and a presentation of a very negative view of our world today, you tell the audience that they should have hope and that they can change the world. Is that contradictory?
No. I mean, what I'm trying to bring into focus is the fact that you are living in an entrancing cocoon. We all are. We're entranced by the images of the past that are played to us on our screens, the images, the music of the past. And in fact, both Robert Del Naya of Massive Attack and myself are as guilty of it as anyone. We go back into the past, we stitch the stuff together, and we surround you by this enchanting cocoon of music and images. And what I tried to do in the show is to actually, towards the end, begin to make you realise that that entrancing cocoon of 11 giant screens and a loud rock band playing music sampled from the past can get quite oppressive and limiting. And that beyond those screens, beyond that thin shell of images from the past that are continually replayed to us, there might be something else. There might be another world. There might be the dynamic forces of history that are going on all around the world. For example, in the Middle East at the moment, I think the fact that we live in this static managerial world has created a sensibility in us which prevents us from actually understanding the dynamism of the world outside. Instead, what we do, for example, in Syria, we turn it into a simple battle between goodies and baddies, because that's what the static world teaches you. There's good people and there's bad people. Well, actually, I'm sorry, history isn't like that, as Syria is showing to us. And I would say, to go back to your question about Mr. President Obama, for all the rhetoric of change and hope, that goodies and baddies view of the world brought him to a dead halt over Syria. And I think that illustrates the argument of my show very well. You cannot simply live in a static world, simplify the world, and then expect to deal with complex issues of the past, of the history, and of the future that are going on in the Middle East. We have an inadequate sensibility at the moment because we live in a two-dimensional cocoon.
Filmmaker Adam Curtis, the new show called Massive Attack, the Adam Curtis narrative documentary with a live score, is playing at the Park Avenue Armory through this Friday. Thank you so much. Very provocative.
A pleasure. Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.